Oh, I'm looking forward to tonight now. Harry Houdini was a Hungarian-American stunt performer noted for his sensational escape acts. He first attracted notice as Harry Handcuff Houdini on a tour of Europe. That's where he challenged different police forces to try to keep him locked up. They could not. He died on Halloween, October 31st, 1926, but he did make a pact with his wife, Bess, that he'd come back. Now, here's the original 1936 seance with his wife, Bess, in attendance as they tried to reach the spirit of Harry Houdini.
Oh, thou disembodied spirits, those of you that have grown old in the mysterious laws of spirit land, we greet thee. We have gathered here at the appointed time. We have complied with all the requirements to enable all of you to make your presence known. Members of the spirit world have long known of the intention of this important gathering tonight. All is in readiness. Please now, the time is at hand. Make yourself known to us. Any of you, please, manifest yourself in any way possible. Please let your united strength and knowledge aid Houdini in coming through. It is the spirit of Houdini we wish to contact. Houdini, are you here? Are you here, Houdini? Please manifest yourself in any way possible. Take from this earnest gathering any strength that may be necessary for you to use. Take any vital thing from us that you may need to enable you to carry out your promise of years ago. We have waited, Houdini, oh, so long. Never have you been able to present the evidence you promised. And now, this is a night of nights. The world is listening. Harry, your world, your audience. And Bessie is here. Your Bessie, who is part of you for 33 years. She's here, Harry, pleading in her heart for a prearranged sign from you. It means so much to her, to all of us, to the world. Harry, we are all seekers after truth. Please manifest yourself by speaking through the trumpet. Lift it. Lift it. Speak through it. Speak. Speak, Harry. We are watching and waiting, Harry. Levitate the table. Move it. Lift the table. Move it. Wrap on it. Spell out a code, Harry. Please. Ring the bell. Let his tinkle be heard around the world. Do it, Harry. Please. Please, Houdini, we are waiting. Bessie is waiting.
Well, they kept waiting. Nothing happened. Harry never showed up. In a moment, MJ Rose joins us as we discuss the history of seances next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. MJ Rose graduated from Syracuse University, spending the 80s in advertising as a commercial work in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and has since 2005 run the very first marketing company for authors called AuthorBuzz.com. MJ has been studying reincarnation her entire life, worked with a renowned New York past life therapist for more than a year, learning how to access her own past lives. MJ, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine. It's so nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
How did you like the Harry Houdini seance there?
Oh, I love that. It was inspired to play that.
Harry, show up. Do something. Poor Harry didn't do anything. So they
No. You know, he actually didn't believe in seances, so he thought that they were a whole lot of phooey. So I thought it was always so fascinating that at the end of his life, he promised his wife he'd come back and that they tried to have seances because he was just so against them.
Well, the seance performer sure was trying his best to reach Harry, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So yes, tell me about you.
She sounded very serious, didn't she?
How did you get involved in all this from an advertising background?
Oh, it actually had nothing to do with advertising that led me to all this. All of this really started because when I was 3 years old, I was at a dinner with my grandparents and my great-grandparents and my parents. And apparently during, I don't remember any of this, since I was three, during the dinner, I started talking to my great-grandfather about the house where we'd broken the window when we were little. And it sounded like, you know, some three-year-old making up a story, but my great-grandfather got all emotional and told everybody at the table that he and his cousin, who had died very young, when they lived in St. Petersburg in Russia, when they were young kids, like 8 or 9 years old, had thrown apples at some family member's house and broken the windows and had been severely punished. And that his cousin had died, and then my great-grandfather had come to America when he was in his 20s. And that he believed I was the reincarnation of that cousin.
Ah.
And he was, my great-grandfather was a Kabbalist scholar. You know, every religion, including Christianity, was a firm believer in reincarnation, to the point that a lot of people believe that when Jesus talked about being resurrected, he was actually talking about being reincarnated.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that that's been a mistranslation from the very first, and that nobody's ever corrected. But my mother thought that what my great-grandfather was saying was a lot of hooey, and but because she loved her great-grandfather and he was this Kabbalist scholar who believed in reincarnation, because the Kabbalah is full of reincarnation, legend, and myth, she started doing research. And there was a book that had come out before I was born called The Search for Bridie Murphy.
Great book, by the way.
Great book. One of the very first documented efforts of a therapist to take somebody back to a past life transgression and help them remember their past lives. And my mother became fascinated by the book and got really involved in reincarnation theory. And it was kind of like just what I grew up with, how, you know, there are family legends and stories. And in our family, you know, we're sitting around and I would get emotional about something and my mother would say, the reincarnation of Sarah Bernhardt. Or I'd do particularly well at a painting at school and she'd say, you're the reincarnation of Renoir. And it was just like a phrase. It wasn't even like a really big deal. But I grew up with it and I became really interested in reincarnation and seances and the occult and started researching. And my great-grandmother, it's an important part of the story. So my great-grandmother, the wife of the Kabbalist, was a gypsy, one of the Jewish gypsies in Europe who told fortunes.
I love that.
Yeah, her name was Annie Berger. We called her Grandma Berger. And I have her crystal ball. And it really wasn't a joke. I mean, she really would have, she'd look into the crystal ball and go into some kind of little trance. And she would call up members of the family and warn them about things. And when I was in college, I just give you one because it's such a great story. I was in college and she called my mother and she said, you have to call her today. You have to call her and you have to tell her to stay outside because there's a fire. And I see her burning in the fire.
Oh, boy.
And everybody believed Grandma Berger. So my mother called me at school, and she said, you know, this is crazy, but you can't go home today. You have to stay outside. You can't go back into your apartment. It's like, okay. Because, you know, I was 19 years old, but we believed her. The whole day went fine. My apartment never burned. I stayed at a friend's house that night. And at about 12 o'clock at night, my boyfriend called me. He went to another college. And he was all distraught because there had been a fire in his apartment that day. And I was an art student. And all my paintings that I'd been storing with him and all my drawings that he was holding because he had more room in his apartment than my dorm room, they'd all burned in the fire.
Oh, my gosh.
So I have her crystal ball. And I just kind of feel like I'm allowed to be this involved in all this because it's in my family history.
MJ. What an incredible story and what an incredible background you have. No wonder you ended up the way you are.
Yeah, all those years in advertising tried to straighten me out, but didn't really work.
Now, seances themselves, you know, I played that clip. It was 1936. Seances were around for a very long time, but when did they really get popular?
So they really got popular during the Victorian era. And when spiritualism, there was just a whole new movement of spiritualism. There were mediums from every era, and contacting spirits became the most popular practice of spiritualism. There were a lot of different parts of spiritualism. It was a movement which came to its peak in Victorian England. It spread through Europe, and then it spread to the United States. And it had an incredible number of eccentric leaders, as you could imagine, and very notable followers. And it was defined by a quote-unquote church, the National Spiritualist Association of Churches, who, quote, said, a science, a philosophy, and religion of continuous life based on the demonstrated fact of communication by means of mediumship with those who live in a spiritual world. So it was more than just seances, but the whole movement was all about this idea of continuous life. So it's reincarnation, it's seances, it's mediums, it's photography of spirits, it's drawings of spirits, anything that can reach out to those who are living in the spiritual world and the belief that life is continual.
How prevalent was trickery in those days?
Enormously prevalent.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, I mean, because it's one of those things people always ask me, and it's one of my favorite questions when we talk about this is, well, how can you prove reincarnation? And there are actually, we can get to that later, there are actually people who, you know, really kind of have proved it. But how can you prove that a voice in a room is real? Or how can you prove a Ouija board? Can't really prove a Ouija board. I don't know. Have you? I'm sure you've done a Ouija board.
Oh, no, not me.
You've never done it?
I'd stay away from those.
Oh,
I've had, well, let me tell you one thing. I had one in a studio in St. Louis once, and it almost shut the whole place down. So we got rid of that, gave it to a news guy in our station who had the worst luck of his life afterwards, and he left his job, got fired, because he held onto that Ouija board. I was going to do a whole program, MJ, on the Ouija board, and I had three guests with me, and all three voted. One wanted me to go through with it, one didn't, and the other was on the fence. I decided not to, and it was a good decision. I don't like Ouija boards. I think they do bad things if you're a believer in it.
That's really interesting. I mean, because you know, I'm a novelist, and I've written these books that have to do with reincarnation. We had last year, we were on with the Book of Lost Fragrances, and now the new book is Seduction, and it has a lot to do with seances. And I had to go to, of course, I had to do seances, and I had to do a Ouija board. And I had done a Ouija board for the first time when I was a kid at a slumber party with a bunch of girlfriends, and I had never done it before. And we pulled it out. We did it very late at night, and we did it very much the way Victor Hugo did it, and we'll get to that, too, later. But it was an amazing experience because when I sat down to the Ouija board, we took turns because you can only be two people on the one we had.
Right.
And
right.
When I sat down, the little thing, so we were all like 12 or 13, and the little table, it's called the planchette, went like berserk. And we had to have one girl sit there and write down every letter. Because I guess everybody who's listening knows what a Ouija board is, but for anybody...
Well, everybody knows here on this show.
It's, okay, because it has all those letters of the alphabet, and the little planchette goes to each letter to spell out words. But it went so fast that we couldn't figure out what it was saying, so somebody had to just sit there and write down every letter.
Yeah.
And I have it. I have it on pink paper from when I was 12 years old, and it was a spirit guide who told me what my future was going to be.
Was he right?
Yeah, he was right.
Huh.
And it was something that somebody told me when I was 12, and it went into, you know, what was going to happen in my relationships. It told me how long it was going to take for my first novel to be published, and I didn't want to be a novelist when I was 12. I wanted to be a painter. I had no interest in being a novelist. I didn't actually think about writing a novel until I was in my late 20s. So I have this piece of paper that says, you're going to try to write novels for years and years, but your first novel is not going to be published until you're in your mid-40s. And I put this thing away, I mean, you know, and never thought about it again until I got published. My first novel was called Lip Service, and I got published when I was 46, or I think 46. And there is this piece of paper from when I was 12 years old telling me that.
So what's your take on that? What do you think this spirit was? Because most experiences I've heard about, they haven't been pleasant with a Ouija board.
No, that's really interesting because it was not unpleasant at all. I think a lot of the whole world of spiritualism has a lot to do with what people's expectations are, because I think that a lot of it is energy. So I know that you've talked about this a lot, that, you know, energy can't be destroyed. Scientists have proved this. This isn't a cult belief. Energy can't be destroyed. It can only be transformed.
That's true.
And we know that the human body is made up of a large percentage of energy, and that when we die, that energy leaves our body and goes into the atmosphere, at which point nobody's quite sure whether it stays together, you know, in some kind of like, you know, imagine, you know, like a ghostly form, that it's, or it just is connected as a mass, or if each particle just goes into the atmosphere. And I kind of believe, I think, what Deepak Chopra talks about, which is the psychic soup, which is Deepak Chopra believes that when that energy is released into the atmosphere, it disperses. And it goes into this like cosmic soup of energy, so that swirling around us and within us and outside of us is all the energy of all the people that have ever lived. And when anybody is born, like a scoop of that soup becomes their soul, so that in any one of us at any time is the energy of a lot of different souls. And he also believes that, and then what you access, that you can access the energy of other souls in different ways through meditation. I don't know what he actually believes about seances, but I start believing that you, through seances, through Ouija boards, through meditation, through reincarnation efforts, you start accessing that energy. And so I kind of like to see it through something that's a little more scientific, because it's very logical to me. You know, Rudyard Kipling said he never wasted a blade of grass, would he squander human souls. And he was talking about reincarnation, that if every plant and every, you know, every grass, every tree is continuous, that when it dies, it goes back into the earth and is reborn as another blade of grass and another tree, and is continually really reincarnating, then why wouldn't human souls do the same thing? Why would we be the only thing that isn't regenerated?
Well, that's a good point. So, you know, in some of your work, you came across the Ghost Club. What is that?
I came across what?
The Ghost Club.
Oh, the Ghost Club. I love the Ghost Club. First of all, I just love the title, the Ghost Club. There's been a movie, two movies. One was like a group of kids who formed a Ghost Club, which wasn't what this was. But then there was one movie about what the Ghost Club really was. The Ghost Club was a group of people who came together in the 50s, in the 1850s, sorry. I lived there, right, in the 50s. It was actually started in 1862 in London. And the goal was carrying out scientific studies of paranormal activities. And well-known members, going to surprise a lot of people or not, were Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Charles Dickens. And they were devoted to finding out as much as they could about spiritualism and seances and ghosts. And they sought to investigate, and in many cases they were trying to debunk spiritualists and the practice of seances. And they led to, 20 years later, something called the Society of Psychical Research, which was also in London.
Okay, that was
which
them.
Which was a continuation of that, which was a little less into debunking, and tried to research mediums who were captivating the European society, with the result that some fakers were exposed. And the great poet W.B. Yeats said about the society, "It's my belief that if you physical researchers had been about when God Almighty was creating the world, he couldn't have done his job."
Hold on, MJ. Coming back to talk more with you about seances right here on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, MJ Rose. We're going to take phone calls next hour, but we're going to talk more about seances and the other side when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with MJ Rose, author, Seduction, the Book of Lost Fragrances as well. Her website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. MJ, why was there such popularity with seances back then?
Well, the whole period was investigating everything about the occult. And I think people were, you know, science was, a lot of science was very new. And people were very interested in things that they were finding out. There were so many real things that were so miraculous, you know. Anesthetics had really been created that were sweeping the world. Like in 7 years, everybody became was able to use anesthetics during surgery. And there were so many things that were making, that were possible in this time period. And the Industrial Revolution was taking place, that I think possibilities seemed greater than they had before. And at the same time, we were discovering so many things scientifically that it seemed like we could find out everything. There haven't really read anything. There are a lot of individual reasons, like the reason that Victor Hugo became so fascinated.
Now, that's the French novelist, right?
Yes. Okay, so Victor Hugo wrote Les Miserables and Hunchback of Notre Dame, and he was a very famous, at the time, during his lifetime, he was very famous, very prolific, was a French statesman, and was really one of the most important writers and poets and playwrights of his time. Was incredibly famous during his lifetime. And when he was in 1843, when he was in his 40s, his daughter, his oldest daughter, Leopoldine, who he called Didine, drowned in a boating accident.
Oh, that's sad.
And Victor Hugo was at the time...
Horrible.
Yeah, he was on a trip in France with his mistress. Just for people who are listening that get very upset about the fact that he was cheating on his wife, I always like telling people that his wife cheated on his on him first. And it was very much okay in the 1850s and 40s in Paris to have a mistress. He was not a terrible person for having a mistress. And he was a very gentle man, and he treated them very well in a lot of ways. So he was traveling with his mistress in France when he was sitting down at a cafe and opened the newspaper, because they had newspapers in the cafes, and he read an article about his daughter drowning in an accident in France. That's on the River Seine. And that's how he found out that his daughter was dead. He wasn't there. He felt incredibly guilty.
In those days, they didn't wait till the next of kin got notified. Huh?
Well, now they, it took him like 10 days to get home from where he was in France. He had to take a boat and a carriage and, you know, certainly no airplanes in 1840. So he got home, and his daughter was already buried, and he was heartbroken. He called her the daughter of his soul, and he was absolutely heartbroken. Now, he was a very interesting man spiritually. He believed in God. He believed in spiritualism. He was very anti-church because he really felt that the church was a group of men.
Spiritual, not religious.
Yes. The church was a group of men making rules that had nothing to do with what God really wanted or what the spirits really wanted. He believed in reincarnation. So he was one. He did hashish. He and Charles Baudelaire and a group of writers all experimented with drugs. And he was very much part of this whole world. I mean, Dickens and Arthur Conan Doyle in 1862 were investigating this, and now we're 10 years later, it's 1853, and Victor Hugo exiles himself to the Isle of Jersey in the Channel Islands because of political reasons of what was going on in France. And now he's on the Channel Islands. He's brought his mistress there. His wife is there living with him and his three children, his younger daughter and two sons. He had four altogether. And a friend comes over from Paris to visit the family. And she tells Victor Hugo and the family about these things that are happening in Paris that's all in vogue called table tapping. So table tapping is an early version of seances.
Okay, I see what you mean.
So it's a kind of seances. I meant it's an early version of Ouija board.
And the table tapper was who? The spirit?
No, the people sat around the table. So imagine there's a table. And then you get a little tiny three-legged stool. It's about a foot high and 5 or 6 inches wide, and it's a three-legged stool, and everybody at the table, all 5 or 6 people, put their hands on the stool, and you ask it questions, and the stool taps out one tap for yes, two taps for no,
huh.
Or one tap for A, two taps for B, three taps for C, and so on. And one person sits in the room and writes down how many counts.
It's like almost like Morse code.
Yes.
A strange word.
And this is going on all over Paris at the time, in the mid-1850s, because we're now like really spiritualism is taking off, and everybody's doing this all over Paris. And so the Victor Hugo family, while this woman, whose name was Delphine, she was a famous playwright, while she's there visiting, Delphine and the family start doing these seances every night. And for six nights, nothing happens. And it's the week of the anniversary of his daughter's death 10 years later. And all Victor Hugo really wants to have happen is for him to speak to his daughter. And he does not get involved in, he does not put his hands on the stool for the whole first 5 days. And on the sixth night, he puts his hands on the stool, and the stool starts tapping. And the second, I guess the second person who says that they're there, because they, same questions you heard, you know, who's there? The second person who says they're there types out, your daughter. And the dean came to talk to her father and her family. And she came many times over the next 2 years. And Victor Hugo became obsessed with table tapping seances. And for two full years, had over 100 seances, during which time he claimed to have talked to everybody from Jesus, Shakespeare, someone from Mars.
Wow.
He even drew pictures. You can Google it. He drew pictures of what he knew that they saw from Mars and what the people looked like. He thought he talked to Jesus and Napoleon and all kinds of figures from all through history. He talked to Plato.
Was he a prolific writer before or after these seances?
He was always before and during and after. And interestingly, during the seance period, during those 2 years, were two of the 11 years that he was writing Les Miserables, which is kind of very interesting because if you read Les Mis, it's very much about rational thought, and it's not about anything spiritual or occult at all. He never really wrote anything about the occult. And one of the people that he spoke to in the seances who came back and back was someone who he called the Shadow of the Sepulchre or the Shadow of the Tomb, also known as Lucifer. And Victor Hugo claimed that he had a very personal relationship with Lucifer because Lucifer was asking Victor Hugo to do him a favor, basically, that he wanted him to resurrect his reputation, that Lucifer was very angry that people were confusing him with the devil. And, you know, Lucifer is really the angel of enlightenment, the fallen angel of enlightenment and education. And education was something Victor Hugo very much believed in. And a lot of people believed education was the work of the devil, that people shouldn't learn so much and know so much, that it really led to bad and evil things. So Lucifer asked Victor Hugo during these seances if Victor Hugo would please write poetry about him and show people that he really was this enlightened being who only wanted people to learn. And Victor Hugo did. And there's a poem called The End of God, and it's all about Lucifer. And my novel, Seduction, which you can read more about the fiction of it at mjrose.com, the novel is really a lot of the true story of Victor Hugo and the seances. And then I take off from this, it's about the Shadow of the Sepulchre and what he eventually is willing to do for Victor Hugo if Victor Hugo is willing to write this poetry and resurrect him. But Victor Hugo was so involved with these seances, and they became such a part of the family that after 2 years, they were all nervous. They were seeing ghosts. They weren't sleeping. They were, no matter where they went, there was the Isle of Jersey had a legend that there was a woman called the Lady in White who had murdered her child when her little girl was an infant in like 4000 BC. And she supposedly lived in a rock. The Isle of Jersey is full of Celt ruins and Neolithic monuments, and it's very spiritual place. And Victor Hugo started seeing the woman in white in his room and developed a kind of crush on her. and became very
crush on her?
Became very sexually attracted to this ghost.
I think Mr. Hugo was losing it.
And the Mr. Hugo's wife was very concerned about exactly the same thing. And so she kind of finally put an end to it. She kind of insisted that they all stop. The younger daughter, Adele, was becoming quite a real nervous wreck and starting to suffer very serious nervous symptoms. The sons were getting involved in it. And they finally just had to end it after 2 years, after over 100 seances. They just had to stop because the family was really coming apart from it.
Well, you know, in those days when we talked about trickery, how many of those people who did these seances were real?
Well, many of them were not real. I mean, they were able to expose so many different practices. There was a trumpet. It looked like a trumpet, and you listened through it, and you heard the voice of the spirit. The people who were sitting there heard the voice of the spirit, but it was really how the trumpet changed the sitter's voice and turned it into something that sounded different. Then there was something called glossolalia, which is a term for speaking in tongues, which some mediums used, and they asked the sitters to participate by singing. And then there were images that spirits communicated through, and there was these two sisters that are pretty famous in the 20th century in Chicago called the Bang Sisters, who incorporated precipitated painting into their readings, and images appeared without brushes, paints, or the use of their hands. And they were paid as much as $150 for a portrait of somebody who passed over. And that's $150 then.
That was a lot of money.
$2,500 now.
At least.
And a lot of them were exposed. There are just old photographs of, it's so obvious when you look at the photographs, but there are two people and there's a ghostly image in the back. And it was all trick photography. But photography was so new and it was so magical to people that they believed
it. They believed that. So were there any real clairvoyant seances, mediums there?
A lot of people believe that there were. I mean, like Victor Hugo's, everybody believes, Victor Hugo and his family believed that all those seances were real. There was nobody fake there. It was just him and his family. There were only five of them doing them for 100 years. I mean, for 100 seances. So who there was faking it? Arthur Conan Doyle went to seances constantly. He hosted them. His interest was a little bit more investigative. But he still went to dozens of seances and never proved all of them fake.
It's kind of funny. They didn't have radio. They didn't have television. So maybe this was entertainment for them.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it was. I mean, some of these people are incredible. The famous psychiatrist Carl Jung had seances with a young medium and experienced unexplained occurrences afterwards, including a knife exploding in his house and a table coming apart. And he completely believed they were consequences of the seance.
Now, what do you believe, MJ? Do you believe these seances are real then and today?
I do believe that some of them were real. I have this odd way of thinking of this. I kind of don't think it's possible for people to make up things that aren't potentially real. I think that some
people, unless you're a fraud.
No, I think that there are some people who then take it and turn it into a fraud. But I think the fact that we can think of it means that it has to exist. That if the human mind is capable of thinking it up, it has to exist for real. And I've always thought that since I was a little girl. So I think that if we can think up the idea of ghosts, that must be because there are ghosts. And if we can think up the fact that there are seances, then in some form there must be seances.
These spirits that are conjured up during seances, do you think they come willingly or do they get drawn over and pulled because of the seance?
So I really think that they're drawn willingly. I think that there's a period after you die. It's kind of like a waiting place.
Limbo?
A limbo, yeah. The Bardo. And I think that there are spirits in that place that do need to make amends, help us, whatever job they have. I think that they only come willingly. I don't think that you can call somebody back who isn't in that place and who isn't there for a reason.
We've got a faked picture of a seance up on our website, coasttocoastam.com, if you want to look at that. You know, when we will look at all these seances and then you tie in reincarnation with it, reincarnation, of course, is something that I would say a lot of people would believe. Seances, I would say it's probably less than 50%. What would you say?
That people believe?
Yeah.
Probably way less than 50%. I bet it would only be about 15% of people who believe in seances. You know, some of the people who sat at the seances, though, during that time period, I just like reading some of this list because I think it surprises people. And when you start thinking about that these people believed, it really starts making you think. So Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the Italian poet, and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, you know, Let Me Count the Ways, yeah. I Love You, Napoleon, Tsar Alexander II, Wilkie Collins, an English novelist who wrote The Woman in White, who I don't think that would surprise anybody, but Emily Bronte, Charlotte Bronte, Winston Churchill went to seances, Marie Chevalier went to seances, Mae West, Franklin Delano Roosevelt went to seances.
Was it because they were obsessed with trying to find out something about the other side, about somebody they cared about?
Some of them, but some of them were just because they were curious and fascinated and really thought that this was possible. You know, Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, went because she was obsessed with finding her son, like Victor Hugo. But some of these people were just incredibly curious. Dan Aykroyd's great-grandfather, who was a dentist in Ontario, hosted seances constantly in his home with a medium. I just think people tend to, not people who are listening to your show, but people in outside of this circle think that it's all so strange. You know, nobody real thinks about this stuff. You know, Nancy Reagan was involved with astrology in a very serious way, and President Reagan did a lot of things based on what she said. So
yeah, she did. She was a strong believer.
Yeah.
I want to talk with you about a little bit of reincarnation, MJ, next hour, and we'll take some phone calls. Your books, where are they available?
Oh, they're available at most bookstores, but especially easy to get at bookstores online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your favorite indie store. You can buy them all in ebooks, Kobo, Kindle, Nook, whatever you have, they're around.
And spell out your website?
MJRose.com, and they're all listed there with links to buy them. Very easy.
You love doing what you're doing, don't you?
I do. I find this all so fascinating. And something happened today that was just incredible where I went into a store to look for, I make journals when I start a new book for the main character.
Yeah, that's easy that way.
And I write what she's thinking and really get involved in her character. And I went into a store to buy some ribbon from the 1890s when the next book takes place. And the store had a whole, like a stack of old cards and playing cards and greeting cards and postcards.
From that era?
From all different eras.
See, it's all about synchronicity. We're going to come back more and phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.